correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com. Thought for the day. Vengeance is your sword. Hatred is your shield. Loyalty is your armor. Hello, Engine Seers, and welcome to episode 60 of the Grimdark Podcast. This is James.
And this is Mike.
If you're joining our show for the first time, we're a podcast devoted to role-playing in the 41st millennium, using the gaming systems created by Fantasy Flight Games. Each episode, we cover one of the different systems, but before we get too far into that, let's talk about our last fortnight in gaming, such as it was. I think that all that we've done together was our Star Wars game.
Yeah.
And you'd missed a session, I think, before that, so...
Yes.
How was it coming back in again?
Oh, it was good to see that things haven't changed, that when I'm away, everything goes to hell. You get to come back.
It's funny, because I've mainly been using the pre-written modules. We've just finished off the Jewel of Yavin, and both you and Brian said to me, oh, we want it to be more sandboxy. I was like, okay, no worries. When this module's over, we'll make it a sandbox. And what did you guys do? Spend an entire session shopping.
Well, is it the first time we've had to shop since the beginning of the entire... campaign?
Oh, there's been some shopping. Yes. There's been some shopping montages before.
Oh yeah, there's been shopping montages
with no
you've
money,
got
though.
Like $300. Well, you can buy a lot of stuff with that.
I think it went alright. But my wife, who was playing as well, she went off at one point to deal with the baby and came back and went, "You guys are still buying stuff." Yeah. Anyway, I also ran my Scion game, which is now a mere 2 to 3 sessions away from the end of Act 1 after only 3 years.
Yeah.
Then I can move on to Act 2. And as well as that, later on today, after the show, I'll be running the first session of Horror on the Orient Express for Call of Cthulhu.
Yep.
And tomorrow, I'm playing in the D20 Radio game I get for being a Kickstarter to the four days of gaming, GamingNation Con 3 in Dallas. So it's a big fortnight for gaming. In fact, I actually originally the game was going to be at 2 a.m. my time, and then I had to fly across the other side of Australia after the game, but instead what I did is I've organised to fly on Sunday now, which means I'll already be in Perth for the game, which will be at 11 p.m, so a much more approachable time.
I've got to
get up in the morning and take customers out and wine and dine them, so could be an interesting night slash day. Anyway, getting into today's show, it isn't only war show. We'll do our news section. It could be a quick brief system discussion. We'll talk about the equipment pattern system from Hammer of the Emperor. Then we're going to be talking about the Tech Priest Engine Seer.
Yep.
We'll do our regular plot hooks and war gear section. We're going to do a listener request and review the Imperial Infantryman's Uplifting Primer.
Yep.
Then we're going to talk about the life of an Imperial citizen. Once again, another listener request. Then we'll do our regular community section, which we've got some feedback for today as well. And then we'll close out the show.
Okay.
So let's get straight into it.
Okay.
Command acknowledged. Accessing Imperial Archives. So, getting on to the news. First off, on the role-playing side, Enemies Beyond has now hit stores. Unfortunately, not stores in Australia quite yet, so we haven't got our copy, but hopefully we will buy the next episode, which is a Dark Heresy episode.
Yes.
But that is now in stores. Also, in just general 40k from FFG, the Boundless Hate Warp Pack for Warhammer Conquest is now available as well. That's really on the FFG side, but... over at Games Workshop, first off, the Battlefleet Gothic Armada game has gotten its first narrative trailer, or basically trailer showing you about the narrative of the game.
Yep.
And we can say now, thankfully, that Ross Watson, friend of the show, creator and manager of several of the role-playing systems from FFG in the past, is actually the story writer for Battlefleet Gothic Armada.
Yep.
So he also worked on, we mentioned before, Regicide. And I'm sure he had something to do with the Death Watch game I've been playing, because there's been multiple references in the in-game banter between Marines about Storm Wardens.
Yeah.
I reckon he was involved in that too. But yes, so Ross did let us know a while ago that he was involved. He couldn't say much at the time, but the good news is we actually are going to get Ross onto the show shortly to talk about, not this show, but later on, to talk about Battlefleet Gothic Armada as well.
Yeah.
So that's a very anticipated 40k game. I don't think I've seen him this look forward to since probably Dawn of War 2.
Yeah.
Also on the 40k side, we're seeing a sort of ramp up in Space Wolf material.
Yeah, all the Wolf and stuff's come out.
Yeah, I mean, I heard rumours that they're sort of building up towards a Space Wolves versus Zinch storyline. You've sort of heard it as well.
There's an awful lot of rumours about all this stuff which has been released so far, and people saying that it's a progression of the storyline, and 40k is heading towards its end times and all that stuff, but I'm not convinced.
Yeah.
We've heard that before many times.
I still haven't seen a start clicking Slaanesh army yet.
Well, no. We'll see.
That's it. And on the Eternal Crusade front, I mean, I guess the big news out of this is that Behaviour Interactive has now partnered with Bandai Namco to actually release Eternal Crusade. So it's now available in early access on Steam.
Yep.
I don't know how long it'll be early access for. There are people who have claimed in the past that early access is actually just a release you can do and still claim the game's in beta in order to not have to do any updates. I won't name the game, but I bought a game on Steam the other day, and I installed it, and when I loaded the game up, it came up with like the most recent Steam news, and the most recent news article was, you know, this game entering early access, and it was from December 2013. So,
ouch.
That's it. So I don't know if, you know, some games do that. I don't think Eternal Crusade will, but yeah. Obviously now the old founders packs are all gone, so if you do want to play the game, the way to do that is through Steam Early Access.
Early Access,
that's
yeah.
That's it for the news.
Okay.
So let's get into the main part of the show.
Knowledge is power. Hide it well.
Well, let's get into our system discussion. I did mention before, it's probably a bit of a shorter discussion because there's not a lot to the system in the book, but I've decided to bulk out this section by actually running through some examples as well. So the system we're discussing from Only War is the equipment pattern system.
Yeah.
And this is derived, as mentioned before, from Hammer of the Emperor. But it's probably worthwhile as a forerunner. If you haven't already, have a listen to episode 30 of the show, Inspiration and Execution, where we did talk about patterns briefly as part of our modification discussion.
Yeah.
But just to reiterate, Mike, what is a pattern? What is an equipment pattern?
An equipment pattern is, well, usually they're named, so Anvilus or Solix or whatever. Yeah. They're named after a Forge World.
Yeah.
So, laser guns are made all over the galaxy, but this one particular Forge World, Forge World Bob, makes the Bob pattern laser gun. And that's it. That they make. There's something slightly different there. Maybe the design, maybe the lensing. Something different in their STC design to mark it different from all the others.
That's the main thing. It all goes back to the SDC, the standard template construction. Once again, when the Imperium was first expanded, well, when mankind was first expanding out into the universe, it wasn't practical to send expertise in terms of builders or engineers on ships because they were generational ships.
Yeah.
Yeah, it'd be three generations later by the time they got there. So instead what they did was they sent machines along that had a whole bunch of templates they could use to produce whatever they needed. You know, agricultural equipment, vehicles, whatever it might be, houses.
Yeah, which is why pretty much every hive city looks fairly similar. That's it, yeah. In standard structure.
And no one really understands the STCs anymore. They just know what they do. You put a pattern, you put an STC template into the machine, you put in raw materials, and it produces finished goods, basically.
Yeah, and the patterns are for everything, from, you know, shoes and knives to tanks and jets.
That's it. And the thing is that as over time SDCs have been lost, have been recovered, have been damaged, you know, there are little variations where we find out on this particular forge world, well, the STC for a las gun says that the lens should be made of germanium, but we don't have a big supply of germanium here, so we're going to swap it out for some other, you know, yep, glass compound as such, you know, or some other reflective surface we can use for the lens.
Yeah.
And that's where you get these sort of pattern variations from. And over time, you know, over 40,000 years, these variations can become quite substantial.
Yeah.
So, I guess, why would you want to use pattern variations in your Only War campaign? What's the draw for the players and the GM?
Thematic, partially.
Yeah.
If your regiment all has a slight variation on the las gun, it marks them as different. That's the main reason. It's thematic, descriptive.
Yeah, I think it builds on the fluff.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, you look at the Adeptus Sororitas. So their standard bolter is the Goblin Diaz pattern bolter.
Yeah.
But when they produced the rules for them in Dark Heresy in first edition, they mentioned they had Sacristan pattern bolters. So obviously, the sisters of the Calixa sector for whatever reason, were equipped with a different pattern of bolter.
Yeah.
And it had different rules, because the Goblin Diaz were subsequently started out in another book.
Yeah.
So it's just a variation on the same weapon as
The entire difference was slight variation to clip size.
Yeah, it could be something as simple as that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It adds more depth to your campaign. And it's not like you have to go and do this for every single piece of kit the group has.
Yeah.
You know, you might just want to pick one piece of kit. It doesn't even need to be like a major thing. It could be literally your entrenching tool is a different pattern to the standard, you know,
instead of a fold out shovel, it's a fold out pickaxe.
That's it, yeah, that's right. You get a lump hammer instead of a claw hammer, whatever it might be. Anyway, so let's talk about the actual system now for this. So first off, if you do want to have a variant pattern on a piece of gear, first thing to do is pick the piece of gear.
Yeah.
And the most common things will probably be a weapon, armor, or some other piece of gear, magnoculars, whatever it might be. You then roll on a table to determine the number of positive changes based on the pattern and negative changes based on the pattern there are going to be. Now, a couple things to point out here. There is no zero on either side. So you're not going to get a positive with no negative or a negative with no positive. Secondly, the table is not created equally. It's not like every single result balances out. You know, there is literally, you know, there is, I got one positive and one negative, or there's one positive and two negative, or there's three positive and one negative. You know, they are all variations that give you a quite a wide range as such, and they're not created equal. It's not designed to be a balanced system in that respect.
Yeah.
Likewise, I think that not all of the actual modifications or not all the changes are equal as well. And I guess there's a couple I came across when I was running through these examples where I thought, okay, so this change has no actual effect on the item. Some of the changes say, if this item doesn't have this trait, whatever, then roll again or whatever. But other ones may say, just it does this, and that will actually have no impact on how the item functions as such. So whether or not you would re-roll that, I guess it's up to the GM. You know, you could still, thematically it may still apply, it just may have no in-game effect. And I guess one of my issues with the system is that I like a good modification where it's basically the rule is, okay, you add this modification and it's plus one damage, or it's plus one penetration, or it's half clip size, or, you know, the original modification system that appeared in Dark Heresy 2nd edition or 1st edition.
Yep.
What I'm not so keen on is anytime you roll a jam, roll an extra d10, and on a 1 to 6 the gun doesn't actually jam. You know, extra rules that you've got to remember as such. I really prefer modification systems that work within the rules that already exist and don't add new things you've got to remember about your
weapon. About your gear, yeah.
That's it. And there are quite a few of those, as we'll see. All right, so once you determine the number of actual changes, you then have to go and roll on tables for those changes. There are three sets of tables, one for general equipment, which includes armor, one for ranged weapons, and one for melee weapons.
Yep.
So, and pretty much there are D10. I think that the negative qualities for general is actually only a D5, but there's a number of different variations there as well. And I guess the thing here is that it's not like you're saying, okay, this guardsman has this pattern, this guardsman has this pattern, this guardsman has this pattern.
No, it's more for, I suppose the easiest example to keep in mind is armour. So, say you're a Praetorian Imperial Guardsman.
Yep.
You know, your pith helmet and your tight red uniform with your jodhpurs and your boots, that's going to look very different from Cadians.
That's it. But every single person in the unit is going to be wearing the same armour, though.
Exactly. So,
that's it.
Yeah. Or at least variations of the same armour. The command, you know, the sergeant might wear something slightly
different. He's got epaulettes or whatever, you know.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. Okay. And then the final thing you need to do is name the pattern. Come up with some creative name. Usually it is the forge where it came from. Sometimes it's just some random combination of letters and numbers.
Yep.
You know, but you've got to come up with a cool sounding name. Yeah. I, for the purposes of the exercises here, when I look up names, I've found going to names of moons in our solar system is a great place to start.
Yeah.
So, lots of good Latin sounding names there. A lot of them come from Shakespeare or from Greek mythology.
They all come from Greek mythology, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the item equipment name as well, always random collection of letters and numbers, usually. I mean, even the Rhino was the RH1N0 transport.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, even the Cadian pattern lasgun is the M-G pattern lasgun originally, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, so let's do some examples. First one, I thought, start with something general, and let's go with armor. You know, let's pick flak armor. Quite simple. So I rolled the table, got a 2, so it's going to have 1 positive and 1 negative quality. Quite simple.
Nice and balanced.
Yep. So for the positive quality, I rolled and got a 7, which is devotional engravings, which means that once per session, so long as it's in the character's possession, which will be if they're wearing it, the owner may re-roll a failed willpower test to resist the effects of fear or pinning.
Okay, so it's covered in prayer scripts, or it's got prayers or devotional images carved into the armor.
That's it. Yeah. All right. Then for the negative feature, I rolled a 5, which didn't apply to armor at all. So I re-rolled and got a 2, which is unnecessary features, which increases the item's weight by 2 kilograms.
So it is covered in large pieces of devotional stuff. Exactly. Scripts.
That's it. In fact.
Large amount of wax which doesn't melt when hit.
That's it. When I actually came to naming this pattern, I was thinking about existing regiments, and I was thinking about the Maccabian Janissaries from that they appeared first in Dark Heresy, but they've also appeared as a regiment in Only War.
Yeah.
And so they have very distinctive flak armor. It sort of had that sort of almost samurai type appearance with the molded faceplate, which looks like an actual face. It's a darker colour, it's got bulkier shoulder pads, and of course the other thing about the Maccabian Janissaries is they are so devout,
very devout,
you know, yes. So I sort of thought, okay, well this is simple, let's just call this Maccabian pattern flak armour, it matches all the needs of the bulkier yet covered in devotion to armour that the Maccabians tend to wear.
Okay.
Alright, second example, I thought let's go for a weapon, and I thought rather than going for the Laz gun, let's do a Laz carbine variation.
Okay.
So rolled a 6, which is 2 positive, 2 negative. So quite a variation on the standard Laz carbine. The first positive, I rolled a 10, which is incredibly lethal, which means that the weapon gains the accurate quality. If it already had an accurate, it loses that. Or if it already had accurate, it gains proven 2.
Nice.
Yeah, so pretty good for a Laz weapon, which, they're not accurate, normally they're reliable, but it's going to get accurate at least.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and then for the second quality was a 6, which is rapid clip ejection, which reduces the reload on the weapon by 1 full action to a minimum of a half action.
Yep.
So
on the carbine, it became a half
action. That's it. Someone's got rapid reload, it's a free action to reload. Yep. Nice. Strip and reload. Nice.
So you've got a nice ejection pull, quick release button.
That's it.
And it's very accurate.
Okay. Okay, negative traits. Alright, so I roll a 5, which is a rare model. So this means that logistics tests to acquire the weapon outside of its place of manufacture suffer a minus 20 on penalty in addition to other modifiers.
Okay, that makes sense. Since those two advantages are actually quite useful, it makes sense that it would be rare to get hold of.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only drawback to that one is the fact that it will be a major drawback to an item that you don't normally get.
Yes.
Because you actually want to go and make logistics tests to go and get those.
Yep.
Not such a drawback to your standard kit.
Well, possibly, because if your standard kit, if you lose your Laz carbine and you have to requisition a new one, they may well just give you a standard Laz carbine, and suddenly you've got something much worse than everyone else in the regiment.
That's it. But wait, there is a second drawback.
Oh dear.
10, delicate. Whenever this weapon jams, roll 1d10. On a result of 1, the weapon's internal mechanism seize up and snap. It must be repaired with a hard minus 20 tech use test that requires at least several minutes before it can be fired again.
Okay. So. Yeah, that's problematic.
For a Laz gun, certainly, or for a Laz carbine, certainly.
Well, that said, is it when you roll a jam or when it actually jams?
This is whenever the weapon jams.
Well, it's unlikely to jam because it's reliable, but it does mean that if it jams, it's
really it really jams. That's it.
Okay.
So I decided to call this the Scathy pattern Laz carbine.
The Scathy pattern?
Scathy.
Scathy, okay. Yes.
All right, and for the last item, I decided to do a melee weapon. So let's go for one of those highborn regiments that have mono swords. You know, they're sort of almost like the cavalry saber weapon that someone have. So I rolled an 8, which is 2 positive and 1 negative. So the first positive was a 3, which is venerable design, which means that the weapon gains the proven quality. If it already had proven, it increases the value of proven by 1.
But
mono swords don't have that, so it's going to have a proven of 2.
Okay, that's okay.
Quite good for a weapon.
Not bad.
And then second quality was 6, which is shearing, which means the weapon gains the razor sharp quality, If it already had that quality or its penetration was zero, first off, it increases its penetration by two instead. But because it's a monosword, it's already got penetration, so now it's a razor-sharp monosword.
We've proven. Yeah, so it's a space katana.
Yes, yeah. Although, drawback, I rolled a 6, which is shallow cuts. So you apply minus 1 modifier to all critical damage a weapon inflicts, including critical damage from Righteous Fury.
Okay, so it's...
It's almost like a... Yeah, I mean, so I mean, like normally slashing weapons produce longer, but not so deep cuts, and piercing weapons produce deeper, but shorter on the surface cuts. So I guess it's more of a... It would be more of a katana than it would be like a foil, I guess.
Yeah, so it's a hack and slash.
That's it, yeah. Sword. The wounds look horrible, but they're not down to major organs, at least, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. And I decided to call this the Desdemona pattern monosword.
Okay.
So... That's really it for the system. Yeah, it's quite simple. It does go nicely with the equipment modification system before, because you can still take your variant pattern equipment and modify it further as well, especially if it's your standard kit.
Yep.
Any other thoughts on using pattern variations? I mean, first off, these rules I think could apply to pretty much any of the systems except for the penalty and bonuses on logistics tests.
Yeah. The only suggestion I'd make with these rules, they are good rules, they're quite robust. Don't go over the top. Don't make every single piece of gear in the Guardsman's collection
a variant. That's it. I'd actually probably limit it to one. I'd limit it to probably one piece of gear. Well, one piece of gear if it's something that everybody has, like their lasgun, or maybe a couple if you're doing like our favoured heavy bolter is actually a special type of heavy bolter. Or...
Now, personally, I'd say if you're going to use this and you really want to, and they've made their own homeworld,
yeah.
I'd say probably do it for your armour and then let each person... choose something. Okay. Either say, oh, we all want our las guns done, in which case that counts as everyone's choice.
Yep.
Or someone, you know, the commissar might say, well,
oh, my bolt pistol.
Want my bolt pistol as a variant pattern, or my chainsaw, or something. Yeah. Give everyone a chance to have something variant.
All right. That's a good option, anyway. So there you go. That's patents. Let's move on.
Okay.
All supplicants report to the administratum for career assignment.
Alright, so in keeping with the sort of general tech topic of today's episode, we're going to be talking about the Tech Priest Engine Seer, which is our final career discussion for Only War.
And
I've got an idea what we'll do next, but we'll come to that when we come to it. So, let's start off with, what is the role of the Tech Priest Engine Seer in Only War?
Fixing things.
That's it. I mean, they maintain the equipment of the soldiers, they maintain the vehicles of the Astra Militarum. Within a single unit as such, like if you have a tech priest in your unit, normally it's because they're there to maintain the equipment that the group has. Sometimes they command utilize servitors, so you know, that they add additional combat variability with the combat servitors.
Yep.
And I guess as a sort of a secondary goal, they also watch out for any sort of signs of tech heresy or signs of archaeotech on the battlefield as such, anything that the cult mechanics would want to know about, basically.
Yep.
They do get a comrade of a sort, that is that they don't get a standard comrade, but they do get a servitor, which, you know, once again, you can buy additional traits for with XP as well, but it doesn't work the same way as far as orders go, that sort of thing. So, and likewise, if your character dies, the servitor can't grow to become the next tech priest.
No.
All right, so let's talk about actually building a tech priest. I want to sort of start with a quick preamble about the fact that I've considered Tech Priest Engine Seers in Only War a bit differently to how I've handled tech characters in other game systems before, like Rogue Trader and Dark Heresy. That is that I don't think the average Tech Priest in the Astra Militarum is necessarily a researcher or, you know, a biologist or someone who's interested in researching knowledge for knowledge's sake.
No.
I think what they are is they are a skilled individual who understands rote task and basically conducts those tasks for the benefit of the Astra Militarum, basically.
Yes.
They're not about learning new forbidden laws. They're more about, I know what I have to do to maintain this machinery, and that is my job to make sure that is done. So I factor that into my decision-making as to what skills and talents, etc., are important.
What's important to the tech priest.
That's it.
Yeah.
So characteristic-wise, I think intelligence is a pretty straightforward one.
Yeah.
With any character that's considering a lot of cybernetics, I usually say toughness, because, you know, you can often take fatigue from things like using a lot of the luminance
charge.
That's it. So, I think willpower probably also fits in as well. And if you want to have a combat skill, they're probably more suited to weapon skill than ballistic skill.
I'd go the other way.
You reckon?
Yeah. Okay. They're more about using plasma guns and grav weaponry and weird arcane stuff than hacking things apart.
Do you really see many like Imperial Guard tech priests having grav weaponry and that sort of stuff? I mean, I would think that the Omnissaring Axe is the most common thing you'd see.
Well, yeah, it depends what rank they are.
Yeah. As they let's face it, they do get both aptitudes. Yes. So they can go either way. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think, though, guns. Go guns.
Okay. I disagree. I say go axes, but, you know, to each their own.
Okay.
I suppose the rest of your group probably has guns, so running forward with an axe while the rest of your group is shooting can be a bit annoying.
Well, you see, the whole thing about running forward with an axe requires the whole running thing, and tech priests, they're not that great at the whole running
thing. That's true, thing. Yeah. Agility, fellowship, they're your dump stats, definitely, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Alright, so skill-wise, obviously things like Common Law Tech, even Forbidden Law Archaeo Tech, because they do need to have some understanding about what is outside the Emperor's true tech as such.
Yep.
Logic, I think, fits in well. Operate, I mean, you will have the driver as part of the group, but obviously they should be able to use the gear they maintain themselves.
Yep. A few trades.
Yeah, I thought, like, trade armourer, trade technomat, even trade scrimshawer fits in with the tech priest as well. Security for, you know, getting into secure technology, and obviously tech use.
Tech use? You think the tech priest should have tech use?
Yeah, well, I mean, they get it for anyway, but, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, talent-wise, I put down armor-monger, allows you to add one to any AP of any armor that you're wearing, as long as you have time to maintain it in the morning. Cold-hearted, so not many tech priests get easily seduced. Disturbing voice is more sort of thematic. You know, if you've got that sort of mechanical voice, you know, that intimidate bonus, and your fellowship's already going to suck anyway.
Yep.
You've got the various things like Ferric Summons, Luminant Shock, Maglev Transcendence. They're all built around people who have those various implants installed, so they're all worthwhile having.
Yep.
Infused Knowledge, to have the, you know, access to more law skills, potentially. Master Engine Seer gives you a +10 on your tech use test, and you can also spend fate points to automatically succeed in doing things like repairs.
I'd say that's probably a good choice.
Yep. Mechadendrite use, definitely. Yeah. You've got it's broken down into two here in this one, basically. Yeah, like the old sort of five and 67 Dark Heresy versus this one. Orthoproxy, I think, thematically fits once again, that sort of disconnection of the brain so that you're harder to intimidate or to interrogate or control. Probably some peers, like definitely peer with Adeptus Mechanicus. Potentially also peer Departmento Munitorum, if you're there to maintain the gear. Pro-Sanguine is always a good one for a technical character to have. And then probably Weapon Tech as well. So, you know, spend... For one round, you can increase the weapon's damage and penetration by your intelligence bonus, basically. So, anything else you think of, Mike? I mean, I sort of... There's not a lot of heavy lore skills. Now, there are more traits for tech priests in... not having an emperor, Shield of Humanity.
Shield of Humanity.
But I had a look through there, and like, okay, they're obviously for tech priests and such, but none of them stood out as like, oh, this is a gotta try and strive to have a character creation sort of point.
There's one, I can't remember the name of it, which increases the quality of cybernetics you have one step.
Okay, well, that'd be
that good. One's actually really pretty good, because although you're going to get hold of plenty of cybernetics, they're only going to be average quality most of the time.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, it probably goes without saying that down the track, any of the tech priest specialised talents from Shield of Humanity are probably a good way to go as
well. Yeah, definitely.
All right, which brings us to, as well, advanced specialties. So there is advanced specialties for the tech priest agency. You've got three, all in Shield of Humanity. The first one is the Architectus Magna, which is pretty much if you want to focus on maintaining vehicles.
Yep.
So very good for a cavalry unit, for example, or an armor unit.
Or a super heavy unit.
Yes, if you've got a super heavy unit, you probably want a few of these guys around. You have to maintain that tank, that ancient piece of technology.
Yeah.
You've got the Crimson Exemplar, which is, I guess they're focused on weapon augmentation, both augmenting weapons and using weapons to augment themselves.
Yeah, they're very much your combat.
Yeah.
Your combat tech priest.
That's it. And then finally, you've got the Engine Seer Prime, which is if you want to be a servitor master and have lots of servitors. And, you know, if you're like playing a hunter in World of Warcraft, maybe this is the the one for you.
Yeah.
Alright, so some tips on playing a Tech Priest engines here. I mean, I'll reiterate again. Remember there's a difference between Imperial Guard, Tech Priests, and others. You know, they are more about the application of knowledge rather than the acquisition of knowledge for knowledge's sake.
Yeah.
So, you know, keep in mind that they don't necessarily, like all members of the Imperium, they don't necessarily understand how a tank works. What they understand is if I follow these sacred rites, you know,
say these prayers and do these hand motions.
That's right. Yeah. If I intone the rite of ignition and turn this switch, the tank starts. You know. So this is really where they come. These are not your sort of Dark Heresy esque, you know, law seekers and medical experimenters. Which is why I left Medicaid off the list. I left anything sort of biological off the list because these are guys who are focused on the technology.
The thing to remember, though, is they're quite low ranked in the strata of the tech priesthood. But they will one day get to those ranks. So if you feel that they do have an interest in biology or whatever, remember, it's just an interest. It's not something they're there to do. It's something that they want to do later on when they go up the ranks.
That's it. Yeah.
If they survive that long.
That's it. More than 15 hours, which we'll talk about in a bit.
Yeah.
Also, remember, I guess they do have that disconnection from humanity. It does specify that, you know, they, once you start down that dark path, forever it will dominate your destiny, you know, they have chosen to give up part of their, I guess, connection with other living organisms.
Chosen is a bit of a strong word.
That's true. In any case, they are what they are now, which is disconnected. But yeah. On the flip side, I'll point out that within a unit, that tech priest is used to dealing with the same people. So,
yeah.
I guess as a role-playing tip, although you can sort of be cold and disconnected from others, you should probably still try and maintain that decent connection with the other members of your unit.
Yeah.
You know, because they are still the people that you are functioning with every day as such. If you have some...
Reliant upon to a degree.
That's right, yeah. If you have some function that you can no longer perform because of your modified, you know, body as such, you need someone else to do it for you, then you become kind of rely heavily on that person as well.
Yeah, another thing to remember also is the fact that tech priests technically are not members of the military.
No, they're still members of the Adeptus Mechanicus. So.
Meaning that technically the Commissar has no jurisdiction over them, the Sergeant has no jurisdiction over them. But if you disobey an order, you're still disobeying an order.
But so. Do they still get tech priests from penal wells to go in penal legions? Because if that's the one thing we spoke about in the before with only war.
I have to say, tech priest probably more than any other specialty group.
Yep.
I'd use the combined homeworld thing and all that stuff more than any other. Even more, well, probably about equal with commissars because it's just, yeah.
Yeah.
It just makes sense.
All right, let's keep moving.
Okay.
Attention, loyal servants of the Imperium. Stand by to receive orders.
Okay, I've got a plot hook for you. The regiment has recently been deployed to an Imperial Forge world to suppress a local uprising. There is even a rumour that cult activity may be behind the uprising, and worse, this world supplies equipment utilised by the regiment. To what level of the Forge world has the corruption really sunk? Do the soldiers of the Astra Militarum need to fear that their equipment may betray them? So, this is one I've used in the past.
Yeah.
The concept of a corrupted factory or corrupted STC and what impact does that have on the actual equipment that it churns out?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it could be, you know, that cult could simply just be a group of despondent humans, like, as per the Severan Dominate.
Yeah.
Or it could actually be a chaos cult and, you know...
It could be a Xeno cult.
Or a Xeno cult, that's true.
Filthy Xenos.
But what impact does a Xeno cult have on the equipment that's churned out as such? I mean, it's corrupted as far as the Imperium's concerned, but what mechanical risk does that present?
Oh, no. It depends if they're a Xeno cult who knows how to play around with technology.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if it's a gene sealer cult, that's quite different from something like a slurg infestation who've corrupted the equipment somehow.
Yeah. But say, for example, a Cornate cult who have managed to corrupt the STC that produces Lehman Russ tanks.
Yeah.
You know, you could clearly have a few, you know, unknown demon engines sitting among your...
Well, it wouldn't even have to be unknown demon engines. You just, you know, add some sigils of corn to the back of the tank so every time they kill someone, it's in the blood god's name.
Before you know it,
you're opening a demon portal.
That's it. The blood letters, like, sit here and take note.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just thought, I mean, I said it worked quite well when we used it in the Unbound. We had you know, an STC that was corrupted, and straight away the group went, oh, STC, fantastic, we'll start churning out tanks, not realising every tank that turned out was actually...
Yeah, well, that also comes down to the fact that they didn't even bother to check it over. Yeah. Oh, we found this thing being held by Chaos. Oh, it'll be all right.
That's it.
What moral corruption could Chaos possibly
have? Oh, exactly. It's all right, yeah. We'll do with that. We'll prayer it out.
Yeah.
That's it. All right, let's move on.
Okay.
Revere the Omnisia, for it is the source of all power.
All right, this War Gear section might be a bit of a longer one to what we normally do, because I want to sort of have a bit of a conversation here about changes to canon. I know it isn't very much in this system, but, you know, sometimes it does. For War Gear wise, I want to talk about...
It never happens, James.
War Gear wise, I want to talk about the Venerable Servitor.
Oh, the Venerable Servitor.
Or just the Servitor in general, you know. I'm not... Because only because there's, like, Venerable Dreadnoughts, and they're distinct from regular Dreadnoughts. There is no Venerable Servitor.
They could be servitors which would be knocking around for generations. I mean, who knows? I think the main difference is that they're all the same. Well, they're not the same, but...
No, that's it. And I think that what a Servitor is has changed in and out of the canon over time.
It has.
So, Mike, first impressions... What do you think of when you think of a servitor? What is a servitor to you?
In this day and age, a servitor
is
a human or a vat-grown collection of organs that could be considered a person, which has been mind-wiped and had various parts of their body replaced with cybernetics to do work, including a large part of their brain to make them more pliant to orders.
Yeah, okay. I mean, certainly... I think that what canon agrees right now is that servitors are most servitors are normally vat grown. You know, they are effectively more clones. They are effectively incapable of any sort of cognizant thought as such. They're pretty much bodies. You know, with a brain, but no actual sort of knowledge or education or ability to really think.
Yeah.
Alternatively, they can be people who have either been reclaimed after death.
Or
have been forced into...
In our old canon, it used to be very common that it was a punishment for tech heresy.
That's it. You had what they called servitude impetuitus.
Yeah.
Which was basically, that's it, we're going to make you a servitor now and...
Yeah, you're dragged screaming into a room while they cut out parts of your body and replace them with cybernetics,
That's it. And effectively, they are the closest thing that the Imperium actually allows to robotics.
Yeah.
Yeah, effectively, because they have an organic brain that governs some of their functions, they are not considered a robot, they're more considered a cyborg. But at the end of the day, they are really their actions are being controlled by a computer. They do have some cognitive processes because when they're left for a long period of time without orders, they can sometimes do things like wander around aimlessly or start to make noises like, you know... not so much screaming, but they can sort of into sort of a seizure-like state as their brain sort of tries to deal with the input of sensation without the directive of action as such.
There used to be the pit fighter gang from Necromunda, which was made up of pit fighters, obviously.
Yes.
But some of the characters were described as servitors that had broken their programming and recovered some of their human mindset.
That's it.
So that can happen, according to canon.
Well, according to a part of canon. Because in some cases, I've seen stories in 40K where people have conversations with servitors, for example. And not just like, I mean, I'll use the example of the Ultramarines movie, which I know you love, where there's a servitor assisting a Marine donning his armour, and the servitor is basically intoning a chant that the Marine echoes each line of, but that could be just an automatic function as such.
Yeah, it's just a program.
That's it, yeah. But I've seen it in some material where the servitor has a level of understanding as such, you know, and is able to have a back-and-forth conversation. And I don't think that's really...
It may come down to the fact that they have different levels of servitor of how much of the brain was replaced and how much quality is in the implant which was used to replace it. I mean... I don't really know. It's not something they've gone into in a great deal, and I think they've left it purposefully
a obscure.
Bit.
That's it. I mean, an arcoflagellant could be considered similar to a servitor, but an arcoflagellant is able to maintain at least the facsimile of normal life until they're
activated.
Exactly right. Yeah. So they have cognitive function. I've also seen in some of the material they often use animal brains for some servitors, particularly things like cherubs or skull servitors, where they use like a rat brain just to provide basic organic intelligence.
Yeah.
Even though, once again, the majority of the function is governed by a cogitator rather than the actual brain. So I mean, and there's servitors for all things, all sorts of things in the Imperium. You know, they support the military, they support the Mechanicus, they will support households. You know, they are literally functional servants, effectively. And even though slavery is legal in plenty of places in the Imperium, you know,
servitors
are also
sanctioned, approved items.
That's right, exactly, and arguably a form of war gear.
Yeah.
So
well, that's it. I mean. Also, how the squad in Only War reacts to servitors is going to be telling, especially if, you know, your former dead sergeant suddenly comes back as the tech priest's new servitor. It's a bit.
You didn't play the Dragon Age game, did you?
No.
Okay. In Dragon Age, they had these concepts where you had, like, a magic user, and the inherent problem with magic in Dragon Age was that it was fueled by the demonic realm, basically. So, like with psychers in 40K, the risk was if you were not very skilled, you risked exposing yourself to the demonic realm. And so,
like Harry Potter to the evangelical Christian.
So, in the Dragon Age setting, mages would go through this test to make sure they could actually handle the power. And if they were unable to, a special sort of rite was done on them, which effectively removed magic from them, but it also removed all sort of personality. Because effectively, like they were still alive, they could still think, they could still have a conversation, they were still capable of making decisions, but none of that was governed by needs or wants or anything other than just what they were told to do. You know, so I want you to stay here and clean up this area as such, and they would do that consistently. They would still go and get food if they had biological needs, or they could toilet themselves or whatever, but they were incapable of forming their own wants or needs or desires. And I sort of think that's probably the highest level of function you could really have in a servitor and still be considered a servitor within the Imperium as such.
Yeah. I'd say so.
All right, just one example anyway, but I mean, I think most servitors are pretty much just, it's they're about as intelligent as a dog might be.
Yeah,
you can train dogs pretty well, but once again, take away their directives and they eventually will go back to a sort of a less feral functional state. That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, let's get going.
Yep.
My lord, the information you requested is now available for your review.
Let's do a review.
Yep.
And today we are not reviewing a role-playing book, although you could very easily use this book in your role-playing game. In fact, I would actually encourage you to use this book in your role-playing game.
Yes.
This is the Imperial Infantryman's Uplifting Primer. So, first off, this is two things. One, this is a book in canon. You know, effectively, every Imperial Guardsman is given a copy of this book.
Yep.
And expected to have it at all times. But they also decided to churn out this book as a, physical thing that you can buy in Games Workshop stores. You can still get it in a lot of stores, I've found out.
Yep.
And, it's written like it is what it says on the cover. Even the first page internally has all the credits crediting the writers within the 40K universe. There is a small box at the bottom that credits the actual writers.
With copyright details, because it's Games Workshop.
That's it.
Have to have copyright details.
But otherwise, everything else about the book is as the real book would be in canon as such.
Yeah.
It starts off with, for example, a space where the owning guardsman can record their particulars, and then also has a page where, like a pair of dog tags, the detail of the guardsman's death can be recorded once the primer is taken from their body on the battlefield. And even that, it's got typical 40K humor. It mentions that it's a requirement of the primer that the next of kin be notified of the guardsman's death only after the Departmentum Munitorium has recorded it in their annals or such, and if there's some screw-up where the Departmentum Munitorium can't record it, then no message should be sent to the next of kin to confirm the death of their loved one as such. So, that's it. So, it's broken down into six chapters plus an extra bit at the end, the red pages we'll call them. So, chapter one is Principles and Regulations. And pretty much these are your standard, you'd call them standing orders, basically, the standing rules of the Imperial Guard. They're to do with things like being in uniform, being on a post,
following
orders, being clean, having your Imperial Infantryman's Uplifting Primer. And in most cases, the punishment for breaking any of these rules is you will be shot.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have your imperial enough, you'll be shot. If you don't follow orders, you'll be shot. Sometimes, lesser infractions, like, for example, gambling, you might be flogged.
Yeah.
Some more serious infractions, you might be flogged, then shot. I think that there's ones that pertain to tech heresy, where you are flogged, then flayed, then shot. Some people are hung, not shot. But there are very few things that you can do that are not going to result in pretty major punitive charges as such.
Well, that's it. I mean, the punishments and the whole system like that is very much based on Napoleonic era English army.
That's it.
Yeah, you know, stealing from another person in the English army back then would result in everyone else in your unit getting to beat on you.
Yeah. That's it. I mean,
until you're dead.
There's things like they're not allowed to have duels, for example, in the Imperial Guard. And even like, yeah, even if you're challenged, participating in the duel is cause for death, basically.
Yeah.
It's some pretty serious stuff in there. There's even things like it mentions that obviously not following orders is instantly being shot. And then questioning, if a superior officer gives you an order which you believe to be an illegal order or whatever, not following that order will still get you shot because you're not supposed to question your superior officers.
Yeah.
Yet, if they tell you to perform heresy, and you perform heresy, you'll also be, well...
shot.
There'll be more. It's more than shot with heresy anyway.
Yeah.
It's a substantial amount more. Pretty much it's at the discretion of the commanding officer, but it will invariably result in a very painful and prolonged death. But, you know, you could always just say no and get shot to avoid that prolonged painful death. There is special information about maintaining a watch post as well. Once again, leaving a watch post is grounds for instant shotness. But in general, it reads like standing orders in a particularly harsh military.
Yes. Yeah,
a lot of fun. Chapter 2 is issued arms, attire, apparatus, and equipment, which pretty much leads you through all the basic gear you get. You know, it details the las gun, how it breaks down, it has the stripping procedure, the reassembly procedure, the standard flak armor, gas mask. You know, it has examples of a gas mask worn properly and a gas mask worn improperly.
Yep.
So the goggles don't line up with the eyes, for example. It gives you your full list of kit and pack, basically, everything that the soldier's going to have. So, good idea. It's a good thing for an Only War game to say, this is exactly what you've got. You know, it does have all this gear listed in the Only War rulebook, but this goes into a much greater detail. So, it pretty much gives you just an idea about what the average soldier is carrying, what the expectations are around that in terms of its, you know, level of maintenance and repair and cleanliness as well.
Yep.
Then Chapter 3 is Imperial Guard Organization, Structure, and Basic Battlefield Policy, which pretty much outlines the ranks, the structure of the Imperial Guard, the sort of daily expectations, you know, saluting, all the various things that would a soldier needs to know about the organization they work in, keeping in mind that, you know, Imperial Guard don't go through a substantial amount of training. You know, they pretty much get tithed into the Imperial Guard, and they pretty much got the journey from where they're tithed from to where their first battlefront is to, you know, get trained in the Imperial Guard. And so often this book will be what they need to learn from.
Yeah, which isn't too bad, so long as you're not tithed on your homeworld to defend your homeworld.
Yes. Chapter 4 is the Imperial Guard Armour and Tank Recognition Affiliated and Enemy Variants.
Yep.
So pretty much you've got pictures of all the various Imperial tanks and descriptions of them. It does mention, it describes Orc Eldar machines as well, like what their vehicles look like. No pictures, of course, just actual descriptions. And it's very dismissive of their technology as well, which
yes.
with Orcs is probably quite justified. Maybe not so much with Eldar, but you know, in general, it's all inferior technology. Which brings me on to Chapter 5, which is by far where this book shines. Chapter 5 is Know Your Foe, and it pretty much tells you all about Orcs, Eldar, Tyranids.
Yep.
What the average Imperial Guardsman needs to know. Or what they want you to know. Let's put it that way. For example, it does point out that Orcs are very large. Pointing out that they're easily taller than a man. However, it also points out that although they're very large, they're not very dense, which means that they're not very strong or not very tough. They just look big because they're tall, but in actuality, their you know, molecular structure is not very dense, and therefore they're easy to kill.
Yeah.
You know,
easily bayoneted,
and it has a bayoneting feature for an orc. You know, you stab it once between somewhere between the neck and the eyes, and repeat multiple times until you're sure that it's dead. Then it talks about the Tyranids. It does give good advice. It says with Tyranids, generally it's best to shoot the biggest one, because the death of the bigger ones generally leads to confusion of the smaller ones.
Yeah.
Eldar, it points out they are incredibly fragile. That they're, you know, their lithe forms belie an inherent fragility where they pretty much, you know, almost break themselves by firing their own weapons.
Okay. So
it certainly gives, you know, this is where the uplifting part of the primer fits in.
It
lets you know that you are a member of, you know, the strongest military force in the universe.
Yep.
And that really nothing that you'll fight will ever present that much of an opposition to you that you need to really be concerned. But, you know, it does tell you what to expect. You know, you might find that some of those expectations are a bit out of the ordinary. Like, you know, that orc doesn't quite die as fast, you think, when you try to bayonet it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does give you a bit of a run through on that. And then Chapter 6 is Elementary Battlefield Medical Instruction, which is basic first aid. It's actually, you know, as someone who knows, you know, who's done like an ambulance course and knows first aid, it's actually relatively legitimate sort of stuff as well. Like, I probably wouldn't be giving this book out as an example to first aid students on how to treat injuries as such, but it does give, you know, for a amputation by gunfire, you elevate the limb, you stop the blood flow, create a tourniquet of potential, you know, if need be as such. You know, it's battlefield medicine. Yeah, it's all about, it's real battlefield medicine, pretty much. And then the last section of the book, the red pages, is basically a whole series of benedictions of the emperor. So pretty much
prayers,
yeah, some nice sort of what would you call them? I guess friezes or images of the emperor in all his glory, as such.
Yep.
That, you know, the imperial guardsmen can always turn to in times of uncertainty, as such. And that's the book. Yeah, it's pocket sized. You know, it has the standard sort of, you know, military Cadia green colouring, so it sort of looks like it fits the part of the an in universe book as such.
Yep.
Very similar to what you'd expect from, say, I guess the archetypal communist Soviet sort of World War II era.
Propaganda.
Where the soldiers would have their propaganda books, you know, that were all party approved as such, you know. So,
yeah,
this is very similar to that in many respects, you know. That's really what the Imperial Guard's like when you look at things like commissars as well. So,
yeah, one thing I find in particular quite amusing is the fact that the vast majority of Imperial Guard probably can't read.
Yes.
So the fact that they're given this book.
Well, there are plenty of images.
Yeah, they're plenty of pictures in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But overall, look, it's a very fun book.
Yeah.
It's hilarious to read. You know, there's some stuff you could definitely use in your game, and I would certainly suggest at least pick up one copy, you know, for your only war game, and let the players pass around the table, because it's a lot of fun in there. You know, you can certainly have, when the GM suddenly says, oh, you know, right, men will be up against orcs this time, you know, someone will pull up and say, well, that's all right, because orcs are, as it says here, you know, in very disorganized fighters, who will charge into a you know, shooting line and fall like animals as such.
Yep.
So we shouldn't have any problems here.
Yeah, as long as we maintain disciplined fire, we'll be right.
That's it. Alright, so that's the review.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Ignorance is a blessing. The data you requested is unavailable.
Alright, so for our final discussion, this is, once again, as mentioned before, a listener request, and that is, what is life like within the Imperium for the average Imperial citizen as such? I've decided to break this down into three sections.
Yeah.
So first off, I'm going to start off with literally the average Imperial citizen, which is a slave, well, not a slave, a worker on a hive world.
I think slave is pretty close to accurate.
Then we'll talk about a soldier in the Astra Militarum, and then, just because we want to be diverse, we'll talk about what the daily life is like for a Space Marine.
Okay.
Okay, so let's start off with our hive world civilian. And I guess a lot of my inspiration for this I take from one of the audiobooks, one of the Inquisitor Eisenhorn audiobooks, where there is a person in that who's interviewed and literally describes their day living and working living in a hab block, going to work, doing their work, going back for the day. So the average person in the Imperium is a worker. It's a feudal society, you know, so there was no such thing as middle class welfare, you know, no such thing as you know, long term unemployed. You know, these people simply could not survive in a feudal society.
There's
so,
no such thing as the perennial student.
No, that's right, no. And that's it. And in most cases, for the average citizen, there's no such thing as a strong education either.
Yeah.
You know, most people will end up entering into the same vocation that their parents did. Because it's a so way...
It's like the old apprenticeship system of the Middle Ages.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the average Imperial citizen will probably live in a hab block, which is predominantly populated by people who work in the same functional area that they do. You know, there's no sort of real estate, I want to move to a nicer part of the hive, you know, for a better view. It's like, you know, you will be assigned...
There is no property ladder.
No, you'll be assigned quarters, you know, and have somewhere appropriate to where it is you have to work, and so therefore you'll probably go to work in the morning along with everyone else that you live with as such. You know, there's most hive worlds have functional public transport, you know, so they'll have some sort of train system or other conveyance that gets everybody from where they live to where they need to actually work, which could be next door in some cases. You know, there's no concern for the fact that their factory may produce enough industrial waste to give everybody who lives next door a short life expectancy. That's not really considered in the 40k universe. And then the character will probably spend most of their day in some form of labour. Now, that may be physical labour. In fact, a lot of cases it is. That being said, servitors do a large bulk of the manual physical labour in the Imperium. So it could be, for example, a factory overseeing servitors, or at least think about like quality control. You know, servitors or machines produce the widgets, but humans actually have to go and sort through the widgets to make sure that every widget is made the way it's supposed to be, and report any failures to a senior person as such. I'm sure that within the Imperium there are some breaks. You know, those breaks may be assigned prayer breaks, for example. I mean, keeping in mind that the ecclesiarchy is all within the Imperium as such, so there is an expectation of maintenance of faith.
Yep, there's an expectation of complete devotion.
That's it. But, you know, they will still feed their workers. At the end of the day, like in the feudal system, those who sit above are expected to provide for those who work below as such.
Yeah, they have to protect their lessers.
That's it.
That's their place. That's their emperor-given place.
That's right, yeah. Because at the end of the day, these people who live in a hab block and work in a factory, they don't go and do their weekly shopping.
No.
You know, they don't go out and catch a movie. You know, at the end of the day, the things that they need are generally provided for them by the system, probably in amounts less than what they actually need due to some administration function, or probably more likely corruption at a higher level.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, yeah, they're expected to get up, go to work, produce work all day, return home, rest until the next time they're expected to work.
And there are no weekends.
There are no weekends, no. There are certainly imperial holidays.
Yes.
So if you look at, I think good examples of this would be in the Shiro Calpurnia novels.
Yeah.
There's plenty
Feast
of references.
Feast of the Emperor's Ascension.
That's it, yeah. There's plenty of references to major events within Hive Worlds where functionally the city will shut down for a day so that everybody can pay their devotions. And people are expected to pay said devotions on pain of, you know, torture or death if they don't do so as such. So, yeah.
But it's also a day of party.
It is.
Yeah,
exactly
it's your reward for having worked hard for the rest of the year.
That's it, yeah. And sometimes you might find that if there is one of these holidays, that there'll be then a subsequent expectation that everyone will work harder for the next few days afterwards in order to make up for the lost productivity of the holiday as well, you know, with no expectation of overtime or, you know, bonus pay. I mean, that's the thing is that Dark Heresy 1st Edition introduced the concept of the throne guilt, you know, that there was a currency and a wage.
Yeah.
But I don't know that many Imperial worlds would really have a working wage.
The way I always looked at the throne guilt was the way that the Japanese feudal system looked at it. Peasants never had money.
Yeah.
They might be able to trade off some excess food that they had to try and get some, and then they could scrimp and save that up, and then they'd have some money. But really, money was a tool of the merchant class and the samurai class, the ruling class.
Yeah.
the idea that a peasant would, you know, get paid for their work is laughable. You know, that their entire duty is to create food for the samurais, and they get to keep some to eat. And if they can't meet their tithe, they have to go into what they would use to eat themselves to pay that tithe off.
That's it.
And if they can't do it enough, they may have to sell a daughter and use that money to buy food from someone else to meet their tithe requirements.
That's it. As you move up through the social strata of, say, once again, sticking with the hive world to the higher levels, it once again follows parallels to the feudal system.
Yeah.
That is that, you know, you had a sort of merchant class, or caste, you can almost say, who were those who oversaw the work of the workers as such, and would effectively sell their product into the wealthier class as such, or, you know, at least, you know, these were your factory owners of the Industrial Revolution, or your more educated individuals of the Middle Ages and such,
yeah,
who effectively turned produced work into an economy,
yeah,
as such.
Or you could look at it like the socialist era with the factory administrators and then the workers underneath, and everyone's technically equal, but
some are more equal than others.
Yes,
that's it. And then, of course, above there you have your ruling class.
Yeah.
So, and these, once again, like, you know, the ruling class in the Middle Ages, were in most cases people of luxury. There was an expectation on society that they produced something, but what they produced could simply be
heirs.
Heirs. That's right. Yeah. Or the labor of those who served them.
Yes.
Was their product for society as such.
Yeah.
And they pretty much enjoyed a life of luxury, as do those highborn in the Imperium as well. You know, yes, everybody contributes towards the planet's overall tithe, and if the planet doesn't meet its tithe, the workers will suffer as much as the upper class do in many cases. Well, probably what will happen is the upper class will punish the workers before they fail to meet the tithe.
Yes.
But, you know, once it gets back to the Imperium, you know, the whole world suffers when
the tithes are met. Not met, right. Yeah.
That's it. But at the end of the day, these people are untouchable as far as, you know, they are the nobility of the Imperium.
Yeah.
Is that pretty much how you see?
Yeah, it's, you know, very few.
I mean, that's the thing, is like, you can have as many different social structures in the Imperium as there are worlds in the Imperium, and that's millions.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to run a game on a world which is based around, I mean, we mentioned last episode or episode before about, you know, the world of Mad Max, for example. If that's what you want, I'm sure there's a world in the Imperium that has that structure where people vie over fuel and bullets.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, in the average Imperial hive world or Imperial world, I think this is the sort of structure you'll find. It's a feudal society.
I think the feudal society idea is the easiest way to go with, and it's the vast majority, because they do. They pay tithes, they earn their upkeep, they get supported.
Yeah.
If you want to go into a somewhat capitalistic society, I suppose you could, but it'd be limited.
Yeah.
Because the ideas of democracy is completely foreign to the Imperium.
That's it.
In fact, it's considered heresy.
And this is arguably, I mean, look at other gaming systems that are set in the far future, so in a clearly sci-fi setting. So one I'll draw an example of is Battletech.
Yeah.
So this is a history where mankind expanded into the universe, and the first thing they discovered was communications, or lack of quick communications, made it near impossible to actually maintain any form of direct control over all the various colonies.
Yeah.
So in actuality, the feudal system was a good system to go to, because it meant you could assign local rulers to each individual area, and it was up to them to make sure their area was productive, and then it was up to them to make sure that they fed back their tides and their reports back to the central structure as such, and you could just focus on managing, you know, the next step down, basically.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, Battletech, once again, is a world of feudal dukes and barons and such, you know.
Yeah.
Same thing here. At the end of the day,
exactly the same thing.
The Imperium couldn't sustain itself across millions of worlds with only, you know, the warp for communication, so it needed to be something that could, where people could be, for the most part, or planet could be self-sufficient, as long as it was required, until it had its next level of communication.
Yeah.
Okay, let's put aside the average Imperial citizen now, and as we're in only war show right now, talk about the Astra Militarum soldier, the Imperial Guardsman, basically, what life is like for them. I guess the first thing to look at is how you come into the Imperial Guard, because you probably started off as one of the former category.
Yes.
You know, an average Imperial citizen.
Drafted in.
Very few people walk into a recruitment office and sign up for the Imperial Guard. You know, most people are pretty much tithed by their world, either because they're a criminal, because they're poor, or because they were just there at the time that they came around to recruit.
Yeah.
And they are packed up onto a ship, along with thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of their fellow homeworlders, given a bunch of kit, and told, there you go, you're off to this particular battlefront to fight.
Yep.
And, you know, let's face it, according to some in-canon material, the average life expectancy, combat life expectancy of an Imperial Guardsman is 15 hours. You know, the Imperial Guard is a meat shield. Now, think about modern soldiers. You know, modern soldiers serve because they choose to serve their country, whatever it is. They know that it's for a given period of time. A lot of them will stay in for life, but once again, they still have the expectation that one day they will retire. You know, there's still the expectation that while being a soldier, they can start and maintain a family.
They can
earn enough to, you know, support that family. None of this exists in the Imperial Guard. Generally speaking, although the Imperial Guard is recorded as having a wage, most soldiers will never see that wage. You know, they'll be told that their wage has been used to pay for the services that they are provided by the Imperial Guard.
Yeah, well, that food doesn't come for free.
That's
right, you've
got to
pay for your armour, your clothes, your uniform,
yeah.
Imperialman's uplifting primer.
That's it. And generally speaking, barter will become the main form of trade in the Imperial Guard, because, you know, at the end of the day, people will want other things. You know, there is still the expectation that I will seek luxuries, I will want, you know, low sticks, I'll want alcohol. And, you know, the best way to usually get this is by bartering what I have.
Yeah.
And so that becomes, barter is a major economy within the Imperial Guard. Once again, the expectation of retirement, it's not going to happen in the Imperial Guard. Even if you do manage to live through several, you know, fronts of such, what will eventually happen is the guard attachment you're in will become so depleted that it's no longer worth rebuilding as such. And it will either be rolled into another unit, or in many cases, simply abandoned. You know, you go to a planet and you manage to push the invaders off that planet, and your group is so decimated that they're no longer worth reconstituting, they'll pretty much just leave you there as a permanent garrison.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost the same way as happened with equipment in, you know, during the Gulf War or such.
Yeah.
Soldiers will be just left behind without, you know, they'll be left given standing orders,
but no
future direction.
It becomes more of an effort of resources to bring them back and send them somewhere else than to just leave them there.
That's it. And likewise, they're not going to use the resources to put you on a ship back to your home world.
There is an exception to this, though,
yes,
which is the Crusades.
Yep.
If you happen to be a guardsman assigned to one of the many Crusades and you conquer a world, there is an expectation at the end of a Crusade that the guardsman will be given homesteader status on the worlds that they recapture for the Imperium. And it does happen. How many actually survive to get hold of those plots of land is another thing, but
yeah.
It can happen.
Can happen. I think generally, you know, the millions of men that the Imperial Guard turns, men and women, the Imperial Guard turns over on a yearly basis, most of them,
probably billions.
Yeah, make that 15-hour rule, basically, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually, when I was doing some research for this episode, I was looking up other people's takes on what life is like in the Imperial Guard and the Imperium as such, and I actually found a Reddit article where someone had, this is on the Ask Science Fiction Reddit.
Yeah.
Someone had asked, in 40K, I just joined the Imperial Guard, what's my life going to be like? And I'm going to read one response here that I thought was really, really good. So this response came from Zians. It's about a year old, this post, but I'll read it out. It says, "Welcome to the greatest service of your life, citizen. First few months centre around training. You'll be issued your equipment and organised into your regiment. This is the 401st tithe of men from your birth world, so you'll be the 401st backwater frontliners. In your kit, you'll find a copy of the Uplifting Primer. This is the Emperor's Guide to the Dark Places, your operations manual and the identification booklet. Lose it at the peril to your own life. You'll also find your MG, Cadian Pattern Las Gun, and 3 cells. Yes, you could power most of your Havelock on these for about a week. No, you're not allowed to do that. Your flak armor is proof against most small caliber rounds. Your faith in the Emperor can protect you from anything else. 15 hours, wild rumor. It would be 2 months in transfer to the front line at least. You'd be training while on the barge as well. Listen to your betters, pray every night, and that plot of land and pension is yours in a few years. Yeah, this is the propaganda that goes out to new Imperial Guardsmen.
Yeah. Don't believe the wild stories of the veterans.
Yes.
You're going to last longer than 15 hours. Because you don't want the men to walk into battle already demoralised.
Yes.
It's the whole point behind the uplifting primer of saying orcs are, you know, weak and easy to kill.
Yeah. I'm going to read one more article here from this Reddit as well. This is from Buddha Face Palmed. And this is a quick summary of what life is like in the Imperial Guard as well, or just some things you should know in reality. It's, you will die in the line of duty, and no one but your family and friends will remember you unless you've done something that only a space marine could do. You're expendable in every sense of the word. Your common life expectancy in combat is 15 hours or less. Your commissar might execute you to make your friends fight harder. Your commissar might execute your friends to make you fight harder. Unless you're in special forces like the Karskin, you're really just a meat shield in large-scale assaults. Your standard weapon replaced the auto gun because the Munitorum decided effective weapons were too much to ask for. Even you can't die when you want to. Even your allies want to kill you. You might be mutilated, disemboweled, eaten alive, disassembled into your component atoms, sacrificed to the Chaos Gods, left for dead, tortured for fun by Xenos, mutants, heretics, and zealots. You cannot think differently, or it's a heresy. You'll be sent into hopeless situations, and your superiors expect you to fight without retreating or showing cowardice. You may be used as mine clearance by being forced to march through a minefield. Space Marines will always take the credit. You'll be given from your home planet and dropped on the other side of the universe to fight in a war you didn't know existed. You will never see your home planet again unless you're stationed there, in which case it's likely under siege by yet another one of the Imperial's foes. 5 million of you dying under a 4-hour assault by orcs is considered a flawless victory by Segmentum Command. Just fighting Chaos has a slight chance of you getting disposed of after the battle because the Inquisitor investigated your regiment and thinks you might be a slight tad bit tainted. When your morale officer says, only in death is duty end, he wasn't kidding, you will forever spend your life in the Imperial Guard until you die. Even when the army, the only ones that still uses combat arms warfare, the army still sucks, since it's routinely losing entire brigades. Whatever army you got allied with, there's a chance a Space Marine that will team up with Chaos forces and Xenos to betray both you and the Sisters of Battle. So, yeah, pretty much not very good for an Imperial Guardsman.
No.
But still could be a fun role-playing game.
Yes, definitely.
Alright, now let's talk about the Astartes. I can actually go to an in-canon source here, being one of the older Codex Space Marines,
yep.
Where it literally lists the data or the hour-by-hour activities of a Space Marine in a given day when they're not at war. Obviously, when they're at war, which is a lot of the time, they are actively fighting a war. But when not at war, a standard Space Marine day looks like this. They wake up at 0400 for morning prayer. At 0500, they have their morning firing rites, basically get their weapons...
Firing practice,
that's it. They'll do that for 2 hours until 0700, when they'll begin close quarters battle practice, which they'll do for 5 hours until midday, when they do their midday prayer. And any who are injured in practice get to go and visit the apothecary at this point in time. At 1300, they'll have their midday meal. At 1315, they'll have tactical indoctrination, which pretty much involves going through the outcomes of the morning's practices, as well as talk about any current plans for deployment towards warfare. This goes until 1500, when they will have battle practice involving heavy tactics and vehicles. That goes for 5 hours till 2000, when they have their evening prayer. And at this point in time, individual brothers may be pulled out for gene seed testing. At 2100, they have their evening meal. Sometimes, in some chapters, they may do that alcohol during the evening meal. At 2130, they'll do night firing exercises in the dark. 2315, maintenance rituals on their weapons. 2345 is free time for 15 minutes until they go to a mandatory rest period at midnight for 4 hours.
Yeah.
Of course, most Marines feel that the free time is a frivolous waste of energy.
Yes.
And most will actually use that to do more prayers, more weapon maintenance, more training.
Yeah. Important to point out that's for the Codex...
Codex chapter, yes.
Codex compliant chapter. Someone like the Space Wolves, I think you could probably consider that evening meal would certainly consider alcohol, yeah. Feasting, boasting, storytelling, all that sort of thing. And, yeah, it pretty much sums it up that they are weapons of war.
Yeah.
They are not...
That's it. They follow Sun Tzu's war that all time should be spent either at war or in the preparation for war.
Yes.
That's it. So, You know, life as a space marine is not one of, you know, frivolous enjoyment. You know, they're not out there going on shopping sprees or checking out latest, you know, holovids.
Unless you're Emperor's children.
Unless, well, we're not counting Chaos Marines here, are we, Mike? We could do a whole other story about what life is like for the average Chaos worshipper.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, true.
That's it. So there's three takes on life in the Imperium.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think they're fair looks at it?
I think so, and I think even if you're a member of one of the Departmentos, so if you're a priest or you're a member of the Administratum, your life pretty much is still a feudal situation of doing what you're told.
Yeah.
That's it. Your life is pretty bland, unfortunately. So for a lot of people, being requested to join the Imperial Guard or Inquisition...
Requested.
Seconded.
Oh, voluntold.
Yeah. It's probably a break from mind-numbing tedium and a chance for excitement up until you realise that excitement's guaranteed to get you killed at some point.
That's it. Probably quite quickly.
Yes.
All right, then. Let's move on.
All astropaths to the choir chamber. Message incoming.
Okay, so before we close up the show, we do our regular community section. So thank you to everybody who supports the show and reviews us. I haven't seen new iTunes reviews for some time, but you know, I do appreciate everybody that passed along our details to new listeners. We do get occasional emails from people saying they're a new listener to the show, which is always great to pick them up.
Yep.
We've had some comments as well coming over the last couple of weeks. So the first one I'll play is actually a voicemail from our friend Pat, who we've spoken about in the show before. It's about Pat as well. I need to mention here too that Pat is actually a game writer himself. He works with a group called Storyweaver Games, and he has produced a number of game systems, mainly using Savage Worlds, one of which is his sci-fi setting High Space, which has actually just recently gone to Kickstarter. It's already been funded, but it does have a couple of weeks left, so we'll include a link in the show notes. If you do enjoy sci-fi games, you should certainly check it out, because we play tested the game in its early days. It's a great game. Pat always comes up with quite different and unusual settings. So, for example, his fantasy game Hail was built around the concept that everybody should play orcs, and that, you know, humans were the enemies and such, you know. So he always has interesting concepts in his games. So certainly do check him out on DriveThruRPG and the other Storyweaver games as well. But do check out the Kickstarter link too. But let me play Pat's voicemail.
Hey, James and Mike. Thanks for a fantastic community podcast. Keep going strong. Now, I just want to ask a question. I'm putting together a 40K tabletop army, and could you give me some advice on how you construct a rogue trader army list, reflecting a rogue trader in the FFG setting? Much appreciated. Keep going, and I'll keep listening. Cheers.
All right, Mike. So we need to think of how we would do an Imperial, or sorry, Imperial Guard, a Rogue Trader army list. I mean, we've sort of done this to an extent with what we did with the Unbound, because we allowed players to take their RPG characters and we moved them into the 40K tabletop game.
Yeah.
That being said, they were joining conventional army lists, so it was like Imperial Guard are attacking or Marines are attacking and they are supporting it. So, like, I mean, let's look at... If you're talking about an army, because 40K tabletop is basically a game of two armies meeting. So what armed forces are a rogue trader going to have?
They're going to have armsmen.
Okay.
Which would be the equivalent of...
Imperial Guard.
Yeah. Imperial Guard with shotguns.
Yeah. That's right. Flak armor, light weapons, basically.
Yeah. Probably not going to have much in the way of tanks. Some form of air support in this form of shuttles.
Yeah, I mean, you could certainly use things like...
Arvus Lighter, Aquila Landers.
Yeah, or even things like Orbital Strikes.
Yeah. Orbital Strikes, definitely. As long as your crew are good enough shots.
What about things like using some mercenary Xenos, like using, for example, Kroot? Yeah.
Yeah, you could get away with Kroot Xenos.
Probably wouldn't have a Kroot Ox.
No.
But,
I think the main thing to keep in mind with the army list is going to be vast majority infantry.
Yeah.
Very few rogue traders have access to tanks because they're not particularly used a lot. And if they do have some sort of ground vehicle, it's going to be more like a light scouting vehicle of some description.
Yeah. I think the most important thing to work on, though, is going to be your HQ choice.
Yeah.
Because it's got to represent the rogue trader and his retinue as such.
Yeah.
The closest we've really got in rules for this has been what they've done with things like Witch Hunters and Demon Hunters, where you've got the Inquisitor plus a retinue.
Plus a retinue,
but
yeah.
But even then, the retinue in that is really just effectively a whole bunch of extra single wounds with a special ability.
Yeah.
And as each one gets killed off, they, you know, it's rather than the Inquisitor taking a wound, you lose a retinue, you lose an acolyte, and you lose that special ability.
Yeah.
And you probably don't want that to happen with the rogue trader's retinue.
Yeah.
It almost needs to be like a veteran command squad, but you need to make sure that each character is diverse.
I suppose that comes down to the question of, is this an army list where the rogue trader themselves is there present leading the army, or do they have a delegate
and
say, you know, you're well trained in leading ground force troops, you are a mercenary captain or whatever, and have that represented on
the In top. Which case, the best way to do it would simply be use the Imperial Guard army list, but allow for some Xenos allies.
Yeah, and change the names of the units.
That's it, yeah. And, you know, maybe customise the figures a bit more.
Certainly customise the figures, most definitely, yes.
Yeah, I mean, in that respect, they are a regular army of the Imperium, just potentially with allies.
Yeah.
But I think if you want to try and capture that rogue trader element, you need to basically come up with special characters. It's almost like you would, you know, want to do a special character for each of the member, like the bridge crew as such that you choose to bring down.
Yeah.
I mean, what rules exist for using multiple special characters in a single unit?
Oh, you can. You can combine individual characters, independent characters into a unit.
Yeah.
But you can't really attach five independent characters together
to make a unit. No, that's it.
But you could attach them to a unit, so a unit of five guardsmen led by four independent characters. You could do. Wouldn't be a particularly effective use, I don't think, because a single, you know, heavy weapon shot with a large template weapon could probably wipe them all out in one go.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, in terms of making up signature characters, we found when we took the rogue trader characters into the war game, pretty much just divide the stats by 10.
Yeah.
That was a pretty fair, I mean, coming up with the points cost was a hard thing, but in terms of the stats, it was, they are relatively compatible in the war game scope. Most people have a ballistic sort of weapon skill in the 3, 4, or 5 range, which is within tolerance for the game system.
Yeah.
You know, the wounds probably has to be, once again, taken down by a factor of 10 as well, you know, but if you're talking about using characters from the miniatures game in the war game, maybe you allow them to use fate points to avoid dying as well, you know, because either they're probably going to have one or two wounds.
Yeah, I'd probably say, though, if to use make the tabletop system work, you'd have to say if they use a fate point, they're still removed from the battle.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
yeah, because otherwise they're just going to keep getting killed over and over again.
That's right.
Until they're dead.
Yeah.
You're better off having them, you know, blown clear of the explosion but trapped under some dead bodies or something. Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And the advantage of being individual characters, you put them in a unit, they're harder to target as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So hopefully that helps. Yeah. Would you like to play Pat's rogue trader army?
With Tyranids, yeah.
All right. Now, we also had a question from Facebook from Jacob, and he said, how do we handle it in our campaigns? Let's say we're mid-campaign. So right now, Dark Heresy 2nd Edition is being produced. We are playing Dark Heresy 2nd Edition.
Okay.
So we're at a point in the game where all the characters are now playing. And Enemies Beyond comes out, and suddenly a player looks at Enemies Beyond and says, wow, there's some options here that I would have used if they were available to me. How do I bring in new splat books when I'm mid-campaign?
Yeah, that is always difficult. It depends what they want to do. If it's a case of someone, we'll use the online game we're playing at the moment, the Roll20 game. My character has always been, I've described it always as being from a feral to feudal world. Yes. I created it with feral world because there was no feudal world
at the time, yeah.
The new book has come out with feudal world background in it. I don't want to, I'm not going to, but if I was running a game and the person said, listen, I've always played it as a feudal world, the feudal world book's come out, can I change over? I'd say yes. But you'd have to recalculate the XP because it would change your aptitudes, which is the biggest issue.
Yeah.
And if there's a negative XP, like they've spent all their XP and they change over and they're 200 short to have got to where they are, that's a debt that they have to pay off with the next XP earning.
Yeah.
I think that would be fine. It becomes more of an issue if someone goes, oh, I'm playing a psyker, a telepath, but the ace role has come out. I want to be a pilot.
Yeah.
It's such a massive difference.
That really is building a new character.
That really does require building a new character.
I used to play a lot of 3.5 at D&D, and there were books coming out for that all the time. Warrior, the complete Sonic, the complete whatever.
Yeah,
the,
and there were
Races of Stone.
There were always so many prestige classes.
Exactly right. And so many times we'd sort of put something together with a character only to find out that in a subsequent book something came out that was more what they were reaching for in the first place.
Yeah.
My rule then was always, I don't mind if you want to literally stop now, rebuild your character from scratch using your options, back up to the point where actually out in the game, and as long as you're keeping with the same theme of the character, you know, if there's little things like, you know, you don't have access to ability which you've used in the game in the past, we'll just sort of hand wave that in the interest of making the character feel more like what it was originally intended to be.
Yeah.
So likewise, you know, when Enemies Within came out, which introduced the Adeptus Sororitas, and we've got Sam, who is playing basically a Sororitas initiate, having been made as a with Desperado. What was the background? I think it was Adeptus Ministorum. Sorry, that's right.
Ministorum.
We then just changed the background and reworked the character, and in actuality, the experience points worked out pretty well. What really happened is the character didn't have a Warhammer anymore.
Yeah, that was the whole difference. It changed from a Warhammer to a chainsaw.
That's right, yeah. And I was happy to hand wave that. You know, it fit the character more thematically as well. So certainly, I think that the GM and the players need to be prepared to, you know, accept a slight retcon in order to allow the player to, you know, use the options that are in keeping with the character. Provided, as you say, they're not literally doing a whole, you know, I was playing X before, I mean, looking back once again at D&D as the example, so say for example the character was a human and they found a prestige class and that would be more advantageous to have played a half-orc, I'd be saying no, you've got to stick with the human. The race, you can take the prestige class and rebuild the prestige class, but you can't rebuild what the character is.
Yeah.
You know, that affects too much. So as long as the theme and the scope of the character remains consistent, I'd be supporting allowing people to use that.
My character was a dwarven hearth guardian, but I think the elven unicorn rider fits my character concept much better. That's a bit much. Yeah.
Alright, so thank you to Pat and Jacob for contacting us. If you want to contact us, you can do it through several ways. Our website is www.grimdarkpodcast.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/grimdarkpodcast. We have a Google Plus page at plus.google.com/+grimdarkpodcast. We tweet at Grimdark Podcast, and our email is show@grimdarkpodcast.com. You can also leave a voicemail like Pat did on our website, following the link on the right hand side. And while you're there, please do check out our affiliate link to DriveThruRPG. If you're buying PDF books, you support both the creators and the show at the same time. Okay, coming up episode 61. It's a Dark Heritage Second Edge show. Most of my planning is predicated on the assumption that we can get Enemies Beyond in the next 2 weeks, in which case we will be reviewing Enemies Beyond, and we'll also be talking about the Dark Pact system, and we'll also be covering off the Warrior role.
Yeah.
So, check it out. If not, if it doesn't come out by then, we'll have to maybe...
We'll make something up.
We'll still be doing the Warrior role, though, because we're up to the Warrior role.
Okay.
So anyway, bit of a shorter show today, just because... multiple things. I want to get to gaming. We have a lot to talk about in some segments, but hopefully you still enjoyed and got something from it, and we look forward to catching you next time. So thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
This podcast is not endorsed by or affiliated with Games Workshop or Fantasy Flight Games. Warhammer 40,000, Dark Heresy, Rogue Trader, Deathwatch, Black Crusade, Only War, Eternal Crusade, and all associated properties are trademark and or copyright of Games Workshop Limited. Fantasy Flight Games is a trademark of Fantasy Flight Publishing Inc. All other materials are trademark and or copyright of their respective owners. All original content is copyright of the Grimdark Podcast. All rights are reserved by their respective owners. Our theme music comes from Mevio's Musical.ly, music.mevio.com.